Connectivity is no longer just communications. It is in fact key to Malaysia's growth. Introducing the National Fiberization and Connectivity Plan, a five-year plan that aims to bring robust, affordable and accessible high-speed internet to all Malaysians. This way, we can all enjoy more economic opportunities and a higher quality of life. U-Mobile fully supports NFCP and wants to enable all Malaysians to realize their unlimited potential. Find out how at u.my/NFCP.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Noelle Lim. With rising incomes and as populations in Asia start to age, demand for healthcare services is expected to accelerate. Henceforth, the industry has been attracting investors, notably TPG Capital, a leading private equity firm based in the US. In Asia, TPG is backing TE Asia Healthcare Partners. And so today we speak with the CEO, Eng Eik Ming, to discuss prospects and also how private hospitals could assist in fighting the COVID-19 outbreak. TE focuses on specialist hospitals. In Malaysia, it owns CVSKL, a cardiovascular centre, as well as HSC, orthopaedic hospital, and soon oncology centres and other medical facilities in the region. Thank you for taking our call. Why do you expect specialty centres and hospitals to be the next wave of growth in Asia, as opposed to general community hospitals like, say, Columbia Asia, that's also owned by TPG?
Well, I think there'll always be a place for general hospitals. They will always serve a large component of need among the population and the community. But we do think that over time, as the population gets more sophisticated and you have specialization, especially among clinicians, the demand and supply for specialty healthcare will come about. This is really not very different from if you think about consumer needs, right? When people used to go to big department stores and have everything under one roof, there will always be a segment of population that wants to go something more specialized. So you have boutiques that come up. Very similar to healthcare, we believe that over a period of time, the population, if they have certain diseases or medical conditions that, you know, that are very localized, they would rather go to a specialist than go to a general hospital because they will be able to find all subspecialties there and hopefully give them better outcomes and better service.
Some of your doctors, as far as I know in CVSKL, they come from, say, Sunway Hospital or maybe even Pantai Hospital. They are just moving from one hospital to another. So what would you offer that's extra now to patients?
I think it's quite different. Our model, you're doing a single specialty, right? We do cardiac and vascular diseases only, which means that if you're a doctor who is a specialist there, the whole team, the whole setup, the whole infrastructure is geared towards your specialty. But a general hospital caters to many diseases, many specialties. The consequence of that is then, you know, you constantly have to fight for resources. You would normally have some specialty assistants, for example, cardiac nurses, cardiac techs, but you don't have everyone that's geared towards your specialty. Something like CVSKL is very meaningful because it also means that we hone the specialty and through that believe that, you know, our cost of delivering service is probably going to be quite efficient. And we also believe that by doing that, we create a set of skills among the staff that will be very meaningful in delivering better care to patients.
With medical care, it comes with high capital expenditure for equipment like, say, an MRI scan. So running a specialist hospital, how would you compare your fixed cost per patient with that of, say, a general hospital?
Because we do specialty healthcare across the region, we think that we have some advantage in terms of procurement. We're probably getting it at a cost that's maybe cheaper than other people.
Another part of your pitch that I noticed something there where you say one of the aspirations, apart from that procurement savings, is the network of specialists working together to solve a patient's problem. And this network could actually extend to the region and not just, say, if you're talking about CVSKL, it's not just CVSKL doctors. Do I understand this goal correctly?
Yes. You know, healthcare and medicine is getting more and more complex. The way to the future is really about team-based care. So you could have specialists, but, you know, we have now reached a point where we're going subspecialty as well. So the ability of a team to handle a patient, I think, is going to be very, very important.
How do you convince doctors who have been operating for quite a long time on their own, being the master of the universe in their little universe, to now actually work together with the other doctors?
That's a really difficult question. I think the most important thing in doing this is to be very clear that the doctors who want to be participating in such a hospital need to believe, first and foremost, that the team approach is actually the right approach. I'll be honest with you and tell you that we've come across doctors in many other places who believe that, you know, they want to do things on their own. And that's actually quite difficult for us because ours is a team-based approach. The other things, of course, you've got to have doctors who command the respect of each other. Right? They have to believe that if they are going to be, for example, referring a patient to a colleague, that that colleague will be able to handle the patient competently and ethically. They also have to believe that the hospital, which is us, operating and managing it, is able to bring the doctors together and able to give them the support they need to make it successful. So convincing the doctors, I think, is not easy, but actually, it's if you look at models of care across the world, this is, again, not uncommon. What we have done basically is try to connect the dots and connect the doctors, connect the management, connect the supporting staff to make sure we can all function effectively as one.
You know, this team-based culture, the one I really know of is Mayo Clinic, and I there are probably many hospitals in the US that follow their model where they work together to try to solve a patient's problem. And what I understand, really, they must have that process to support that. So how would your process be different from, say, a conventional hospital where the doctors tend to just work on their own?
We make sure that this is actually a clinician decision, right? We're there to support them, but we may put this responsibility and accountability to the doctors. So that if you want to recruit two more cardiologists or two more surgeons, it's your decision, and you have to be then responsible to believe that they can work well with you. Because if not, then, you know, for us to recruit someone that can't work with a group, I think is going to be problematic.
So I understand your model, the doctors will have a stake in the profits.
So all of them who come in, they will be shareholders. They will be part owners of this enterprise. Yet ownership, there is responsibility. Doctors with investors and operators like ourselves and TE.
When I read some reports in the US where there are studies into the effects or the impact of specialty hospitals, and one of the points that they raise is that doctors will have a stake in the profits, like shareholders, being, you know, really having skin in the game. How do you manage any potential conflict between clinical appropriateness and financial incentive? I mean, this is a point that is raised about, you know, specialty hospitals. I mean, it's been one of the criticisms of such hospitals in the US. So I'm wondering, in your setup, like, what is that check and balance?
Firstly, I think this phenomena of this moral hazard, if you may, happens also, I would argue, the same happens whether it's a general hospital in solo practitioners, and that is not unique to us. So that's first thing I'll say. The second thing is that I think we entered into this business and this enterprise of providing healthcare with a few very key principles. This is a long-term business. And this is reputation that needs to be built up over time. If we are not doing things right, we are not going to be sustainable. Our doctors are seasoned enough to understand that this kind of short-term practices will not be helpful. But the fact that they are shareholders and knowing that investors will consider long-term viability of a hospital, I think it's the natural check and balance. We have medical committees. As a board, we always check and make sure that we are doing right things. Pricing is correct. We adhere to whatever regulations. We've got to make sure that we have processes where things can be escalated right up to the board level if there are improper practices.
Can I say, like, from the sound of it, in terms of reputation and so forth, like processes, are you looking to be like the Mayo Clinic? Like, is that the kind of reputation you want to work towards?
Mayo Clinic is more widely known as being a destination medicine. In principle, yes, we want to be known as destination medicine. Focus is on the doctors, on the patients, and on the processes to make sure that we can provide better outcomes, we can provide a service that's unparalleled in the region.
Talking about cardio and also oncology, there's so much treatment that I hear of that's happening in the UK and the US. In most parts of Asia, I'm still seeing very standard chemotherapy treatment. So will your oncology centres be a bit more advanced than what's being offered here, or is it still going to be that standard radiotherapy treatment?
Well, you know, Noelle, we want to try to be ahead of the curve as much as possible. In Malaysia, we don't have an oncology centre yet. Hope there'll be one coming up soon, which we can announce. But for cardiac, for example, we are pushing for a lot of new treatments which may be not so common. So one of the treatments that we are doing in CVS, which is much more complex but is very helpful to patients, is TAVI, T-A-V-I. But this requires, you know, not just good clinicians but good backup from the support staff and also the implant makers. I do think that as you have more and more capability doing this, you will get better and it will get better publicity. And then there's an incentive, not just for hospitals, but also drug makers, stent makers and all to participate in this type of new technology. When the initial state, you have to remember, a lot of these costs are very high. And even though the costs are very high, the margins, I can tell you, for this are actually very, very low. In a lot of cases, we don't really make any money or any profit out of it. But we believe these are new treatments that can help. Now, on oncology, the reality is for some countries, the demand and the ability to pay is just not high enough for many of the drug makers to bring in new drugs. It's very tough. So you end up with what is more conventional type of therapy. But not just that, the ability to administer them is also much more complex. So you need both a combination of market demand that's strong, but you also need on the supply side people who can do these things well.
On The Breakfast Grill, I am speaking with Eng Eik Ming, CEO of TE Asia Healthcare Partners, the owner of CVS KL Hospital in KL Central. After this, we'll continue our discussion on advancing medical care in this region. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Eng Eik Ming, CEO of TE Asia Healthcare Partners, is on The Breakfast Grill today. What will help bring down the cost of medical care? For example, would sourcing from Chinese biotechnology companies that are said to be producing drugs at lower cost than their Western peers, would that help?
Yes, that could be one. But I think what would be helpful is also for countries, and this really needs a wider, more global effort, where training, I think, is very important. Inter-country cooperation can be helpful. Medical schools and universities are very used to doing this. They have fellowship programs, training programs.
I mean, do you see Singapore can take a lead? Like, how can they help you lower the cost of training or take the lead in training more doctors in this region?
It's not just doctors. I mean, you're talking about nurses, pharmacists, you're talking about therapists. You need a whole ecosystem to support the industry. So it needs a concerted effort. And one of the things that I think will be extremely useful to bring this cost down, be more efficient, is one, I would say, looking at current regulations. The medical world is changing so fast. Are your medical regulations, for example, still relevant? Are they keeping in touch with technology? Public sector devoting part of the budget to, as you say, new therapies, to training. I think that's often overlooked. And also the private sector can play a part in it. CVS KL, for example, we train new doctors. We have fellowship programs. We have CSR programs. So we try to be involved in the wider ecosystem as well. China, for example, I think is also quite good. I mean, many of their rules may have been quite archaic, but they have established a practice where they're willing to relook at the rules. If you can show and prove evidence-based that these rules don't apply anymore, or you can show that what you're doing or your new device or your new practice doesn't pose a danger.
Speaking about competent healthcare, Malaysia has stopped training new housemen in government hospitals. And over time, our local doctors may also leave us to work abroad, like in Singapore, to earn more. So we'll have attrition. So say in 10 or 15 years, do you foresee we'll have a shortage of Malaysian doctors?
Okay, firstly, Noel, I would have to confirm. First, I'm not too familiar with the system of training in Malaysia. I would say overall, the pattern of need or demand is changing quite quickly. And I worry whether we are producing doctors for the future as fast as we should. So we don't have enough specialists who spend time on geriatrics or on behavioral medicine. And I foresee that this is going to be a problem in the future.
Japan, Singapore being an aging society is not a new phenomenon. We know that for the last 10 to 20 years. Why is it that students don't pick
that kind of specialty? Well, part of it is schools. Part of it is also aspirations of people, right? I mean, geriatrics may not be as appealing or doesn't sound as, for example, glamorous as maybe being a plastic surgeon. But this is where the hand, I think, of public policy has to happen. Where you may have to say that, you know, certain percentage of students, would you want to channel them to these specialties because it is important. And sometimes I think as regulators or some policymakers have just, you know, failed to see that these are things that are going to happen sooner than later. In fact, one of the things I would perhaps suggest to schools and universities in terms of thinking about medical education is maybe follow what the US is doing, where medical school is not an undergraduate school, but a postgraduate school. So you will tend to get students who have experienced a bit more of life and students who, you know, who have probably, hopefully by then, decided what they really want to do and have certain level of maturity.
Well, that's the human capital side. So, you know, the use of artificial intelligence, there's all this talk, like, for example, using IBM Watson to do first level screening for better detection. I'm wondering, what is the reality on the ground, like for CVSKL?
We are looking into that. We're exploring using it, for example, in some aspects of diagnostics and imaging. There's a lot of science to it, but there's also an art to it. And that's where I really think it's very hard to replace the human being behind it. Then there's a question of liability. It may be a good thing, but then the liability, where does it fall? So that also becomes a problem. I mean, even simple things like, for example, telemedicine, it's not as well developed in this region yet because the law is unclear about it in many places.
Is it about the data privacy?
It's not just about data privacy, but how do you arrive at a diagnosis and who's responsible for it? What are the steps to ensure that it's proper care? So if you use telemedicine, who signs off on the report? Who's responsible? Many countries, they still require a physical presence. And that's tough, right? In some places, just not possible to do that if you want to be efficient. The legal framework is still uncertain on it.
One of your doctors decides to retire, or maybe for medical reasons, he has to retire. Does he have to sell back his shares, or he can keep his shares but be a retired partner?
Well, it's actually a whole lot more complex than that. And maybe not for this time, but I think, let me just put it very roughly that firstly, we do have provisions where, you know, doctor shareholders, if for whatever reason, health reasons or whatever, we make sure that there's provisions where they can actually sell back to the practice, okay? And it will be at market value, so they don't lose anything. In fact, we give them very good provisions where what we call good levers, where they have, for whatever reason, they cannot continue, they actually don't lose, in fact, they don't lose any money. But more importantly, to your point, to your question, rather, is the principle is that any doctor who practices with us, we want them to be a part owner of the business. So, for example, if you have a doctor who has decided to retire, then, you know, they may keep some shares, but, you know, a big part of the shares, part of the shares will need to be sold to the new doctor who's coming in, taking over his or her place.
Now it might not seem to be a problem because it's still maybe quite early days, but then I can imagine 20 years time, this might become quite a heated debate, and you know, it's about finding the right fit. The new person has to have the right fit with the existing doctors.
What we're trying to create is not a group, well, it's a group practice, but it's a group practice that is institutionalized, right? So over time, as we evolve and we mature, I want people to join CVSKL because it's CVSKL. I want people to join our Hong Kong Cancer Centre, HKILC, because it's HKILC, not because of one or two or three doctors, right? over time, it should have, like you said, Mayo. It's got to have a name by itself. So it will develop its own ethos, it's develop its own culture, its own values. We think these are important things. So as the doctors come in, they'll feel that it's kind of a bit like self-selection. If you're this kind of person, you believe in these things, you will gravitate to something like CVSKL.
And now on something quite serious, Malaysia has over 2,600 COVID-19 cases, and this number could increase as we test more patients. How could private hospitals like CVSKL pitch in should the COVID-19 outbreak gets really out of hand in Malaysia or in any other countries that you operate in?
You've got to prepare yourself that you may have cases that come in. How are you going to deal with it, right? So it's simple things as, you know, making sure that people do a travel declaration, you do temperature checks and all. You know, I'll give you an example. In Hong Kong, one of the things we're doing is we are actually responding to the Hong Kong government, because the Hong Kong, as you know, well, it's better now, but at least in a month before, they were quite overstretched. And we have a cancer center there. Now, the government had to scale back on some of the work done in the public hospitals and started asking whether the private sector can help on some things. For example, on imaging or on, you know, providing chemotherapy or radiation. And we've offered to do that. We're a cardiac hospital in Kuala Lumpur. There are some things that, you know, we can do. Yeah, probably. And I think we've always said that, you know, in times of, you know, like this, we do collaborate with the public hospitals. But the first step would be really, you know, making sure that you have precautions yourself, that the private sector also doesn't put itself into a situation where you can't function. Then you've lost a lot of capability within the country, right? Hong Kong healthcare is extremely subsidized, I would say, for the residents, right? Typically, the government will negotiate a rate with the private. It's like a PPP, private-public partnership.
So they will pay you?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, based that's on right.
So the public, so the public patients that get moved to our facilities, the patients themselves, well, there are many schemes, but typically you don't want the burden to be 100% on the patient, right? Because they wanted to go to a public facility cannot accommodate them, government push them over. So usually the government will pay part of it.
So are you anticipating there will be some cases that will be coming from the public hospital as a result of
It probably won't apply so much to CVSKL because we're a specialty cardiac hospital, yeah?
Okay. Or even cardiac cases to be moved to you?
I mean, we do collaborate with some of the hospitals, actually as part of CSR. Possible. I think it's very possible. And I think it's actually not a bad thing because, you know, in a lot of countries, you do see the public sector being quite burdened. If there are ways which we can help, we are certainly happy to do so.
Thank you for speaking with us. Eng Ek Ming, CEO of TE Asia Healthcare Partners. I'm Noel Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, encouraging you to stay home during this period of movement control.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.